pleasing the crowd. Crowd pleaser, always pleasing the crowd. Still the crowd pleaser, always pleasing the crowd. Still the crowd pleaser, always pleasing the crowd pleaser, always pleasing the crowd. Steal the crowd from you like it wasn't even your crowd. Frontin' like your shows is live, you there stuntin'. Waiting for a round of applause, you hear nothing. Me, I keep the fans cheering. If you think you nice, must be something wrong with your damn hearing. I'm a threat to your top 10. The best and I'm proud, I move the crowd like Eric B and Rakim. Catch a dose of the dopeness, doper than dopest. You are now rocking with the dopest. Can't stop me, I'm focused. I drop power lines, notice the signs is high voltage. Every verse is a shocker. Me against you, it's like a shark versus a lobster. Hope you understand me clear, it's like I'm robbing the crowd. How I got the hands in the air, chop.
Crowd, crowd, please, I register off the meter. Crowd, crowd, please, I register off the meter.
Radio, Wednesdays 10 p.m. to midnight on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. Let's go.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it, and I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
to my heart speak.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
I'll wait for you.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
Good morning. We are in studio. I'm Catherine Davis with
Paulette Spencer
and
Matt Mazza.
And we are here with you. This is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And we have been here sharing this show for a couple of years now, it seems. We started out with a tribute program for Robert Knight and his program Earthwatch. And then we transitioned into Earth at Midnight, and it was myself and Paulette. And then we merged Heart of Mind with Earth at Midnight, and it became Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And now we're going to be making another change. This program has been scheduled to go back to the afternoons at 1 p.m., and I believe Health Action will be in this slot. I'm not sure. But, you know, best laid plans. We'll find out when it occurs or if it occurs. But we are, certainly the program Earth at Midnight was a fusion of the inspiration started by Robert Knight and Earthwatch. And so Paulette has really taken this on with a series of interviews about space, about war, about nuclear power, about Cuba, lots of very relevant issues that have a great deal of impact on our lives as well as on how we can come to conduct ourselves in a conscious manner. So I think that's important too. Certainly consciousness is very relevant to one's spirituality and one's spiritual countenance. So, Paulette, you wanted to say a little something about your interview coming up?
Yes, indeed. This evening we're going to listen to an interview with Mr. Bruce Gagnon, who is a peace activist and has done work for many decades looking at militarism in space.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this should be interesting. We're going to start out, though, with a little bit of music, and we're going to hear Manfred Mann with God on Our Side, and we'll be right back.
My name, it is nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is a part of the free West. I was taught and brought up there, its laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it. They tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. For the country was young, with God on its side. Oh, before the First World War. It came and it went. The reason for fighting I never could get, but I learned to accept it, accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. And then the Second World War, it came to an end. We forgave the Germans, and now we are friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side. But now we have weapons of chemical dust, and if by them we're forced to, why then by them we must. One push of the button and a shot the world wide, and you never ask questions when God's on your side. Oh, many a long hour I've thought on this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you will have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. And now as I leave you, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, there ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and drop to the floor, that if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.
You're listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight on Pacifica Radio Network, WBAI Radio in New York City. My name is Paulette Spencer. We are very lucky to have with us this evening Mr. Bruce Gagnon, who is founder and coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Mr. Gagnon has been involved in space issues for more than 30 years, and he is a member of Veterans for Peace. He is also the author of Coming Together, Organizing Stories for Fading Empires. Thank you, Mr. Gagnon, for taking the time to be with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, please tell us about the work of your organization.
Well, we were created in 1992. This is 2017 is our 25th year of operation, created to build an international consciousness and a constituency that could move into action around the whole issue of protecting space from a new arms race and from the nuclearization that the nuclear industry is just salivating to put into motion. They view space as a new market. So today we have about 150 affiliate groups all over the world, because what we discovered over the years was that the U.S. Space Command has been setting up downlink stations around the planet that they use to communicate with U.S. military satellites as they orbit the Earth. And the satellites beam their signals down to a downlink station and bounces from there to other satellites and on to the United States to headquarters. So people in these countries of Australia and England, Germany, Sweden, many other countries around the world don't
I wanted to start with an overview of the American missile defense system for those of our listeners who may not completely understand the depth of the what the implications are here. The core of the operations take place at the Strategic Command Center in Nebraska, is that correct?
That's right. STRATCOM, they call it. STRATCOM is sort of in charge of everything these days, missile defense, all space weapons technologies program. They're in charge of the NSA that does the spying and interception, all phone, fax, email communications around the world. And many of these bases, downlink bases I was talking about, are actually NSA listening posts in, for example, Australia and England and New Zealand, the three of the bigger ones. This is all part of STRATCOM's mission. They're in charge of the nuclear bombers, so that really they're in charge of all U.S. offensive technology today, including cyber warfare.
I refer to the 1997 document titled Space Command Vision 2020, and I see that the text really lays out the intentions of the U.S. government to pursue its interests of national security and corporate interests through warfare. Can you elaborate on this document, please?
They say that the U.S. will, under corporate globalization, be in a position to essentially control the planet on behalf of the corporations. So that means controlling resources, controlling shipping lanes, controlling the ground, the air above the ground for the Air Force, and ultimately space, including, and then the oceans as well. So they call that full spectrum dominance. Probably a lot of people have heard that phrase by now. But it all comes out of this Space Command planning document. They say the U.S. will be the master of space, and in fact, in Colorado, at Colorado Springs, Peterson Air Force Base, the headquarters of the Space Command, above their doorway, they have this as a logo, Master of Space, and they wear it as a patch on their uniform, too. And in that planning document, they say the U.S. will control space, dominate space, and most importantly of all, deny other countries access to space so that the U.S. will be the master of space. So today all warfare on the planet is coordinated and directed by military space technology. So no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, you're in a boat, you're on a plane, or there are satellites flying above the Earth, everything is coordinated and directed by U.S. space technology. When George W. Bush launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used were directed to their targets by military satellites. So we like to say that military satellites have essentially become the triggers for all warfare, so that even drones today are flown and directed by U.S. military satellites. So while the drones deliver weapons, they do a lot of surveillance, it's really the satellites, the very expensive military satellites of the Pentagon that are controlling all of those operations.
And in terms of the control of space, isn't that in direct violation of treaties that the U.S. has actually ratified?
Yeah, there are two treaties, the Moon Treaty, which the United States never ratified, but the Outer Space Treaty that says that no country can claim ownership of any of the planetary bodies, nor no one can put weapons of mass destruction in space. And the U.S. Way around that treaty today, which we did sign, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the U.S. says that the weapon systems that we now are using
I wanted to move to the current administration, the new administration of Donald Trump, and the legacy that Barack Obama left behind in terms of the encircling of Russia and China. I saw a recent document that stated that in 2015, Obama used about 50% of his discretionary budgeting for the military and roughly, I guess, 3% each in the areas of education and health. What does this bode for China and Russia as Obama has left the legacy of the activities in Ukraine, what we're now seeing in South Korea, as well as the presence in the Arctic?
Well, that's a big question. Let me try to take it in pieces. First of all, I think it's important to know that the United States, through elite organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, that almost all of the politicians and corporate operatives in both political parties belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. And for many years, they are the preeminent organization that really controls America. They've long been saying that we the United States, will not stand for any challengers to our total control of the planet, both economically and militarily. And what we see now with the rising of China and the comeback of Russia after many, many years of after the fall of the Soviet Union and the U.S. Sending in the Harvard boys to privatize their economy and sell off the assets and reduce their economy to virtually nothing. Under Putin, they've made a great recovery, and this, I believe, is one of the reasons why we see so much demonization of Vladimir Putin, because he's dared bring Russia back to a respectable place in the world. And so the thought of Russia and China together competing with the United States on a global level, creating essentially a multipolar world rather than a unipolar world where the U.S. was in control of everything after the end of the Cold War. And so the U.S. is out now, while it still can, to try to disrupt that process, to try to break these two countries back. And in fact, we've seen repeatedly calls from the United States for regime change in both Moscow and Beijing. ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that banned either side, the United States or the former Soviet Union, from having missile defense systems, because both sides during the Cold War knew they were provocative. They would give one side an advantage. And so they signed a treaty. But in 2001, soon after George W. Bush became president, he withdrew from that treaty. And now missile defense is on steroids. And so actually every year at the U.S. Space Command, they have a computer war game. It's called the Red Team versus the Blue Team. And in that computer war game, the United States launches a preemptive first strike attack on Russia and China. And when they try to respond in that war game, the United States uses its growing deployments of missile defense systems to pick off their retaliatory capability, giving the U.S. a quote-unquote successful first strike attack. And so today, in addition to Russia being surrounded by missile defense, the United States is also surrounding China with missile defense systems, putting them into Taiwan, Japan, Okinawa, South Korea, Guam, and again on these Navy Aegis destroyers outfitted with missile defense interceptors that are bumping up along the coast of China.
And I understand some of these missile defense tactics are highly inefficient and have a very low quote-unquote success rate. Am I correct?
Well, there are various kinds. There's like four or five different kinds of missile defense systems. And for some, that is true. But for others, it is not true. But the one is called National Missile Defense. Its job is to have a bullet hit a bullet way up in deep space when things are flying at 15,000 miles an hour, when they can, say, so you're going to try to take out a missile way up in deep space, flying at 15,000 miles an hour. It releases decoys. You can't really tell what's what. That system, National Missile Defense, is not having any success whatsoever. The system of putting interceptors, they're called SM-3 interceptors, Standard Missile 3, third generation. Those are the ones being put on U.S. Navy Aegis destroyers. And these systems are having a very good testing rate. And so it is this program that the Obama administration, during his 8 years in office, accentuated, built more of, deployed in more places, and now is moving them not only onto ships, as I said, but also moving these same interceptor missiles onto what they call Aegis Ashore, ground-based launchers, and they just built an Aegis Ashore system in Romania and opened it in 2016, and now they're going to put one in Poland next year. So it depends on which system you're talking about. So you can't generalize and say missile defense doesn't work, it's a boondoggle, because some of the systems, in fact, are working. In fact, the one on the ship, the SM-3 interceptor missile, was used by the United States to fire and hit an old U.S. military satellite to show that we had anti-satellite capability, that we could knock out another country's satellite with these same so-called missile defense systems. So they're proving to be very dangerous and very provocative. And in fact, this whole idea of taking out other countries' satellites, which is beyond provocative, beyond dangerous, seems to be gaining sway within the new Trump administration. There are many people in the Republican Congress that are very excited about moving forward with U.S. anti-satellite weapons systems.
And speaking of space, what effect would all of this have on the environment, on the quality of our planet, the air we breathe, the ability for a spacecraft to actually venture into space without being hit by projectiles traveling around the globe? Where would we stand when if all of this is successful or is not curtailed?
You're talking about space debris or space junk,
yes,
which is already a huge problem in space. Massive amounts of orbiting, tiny little bits of things, nuts, bolts, screws, specks of paint. One time, the window on one of the Challenger shuttles was broken by an orbiting speck of paint. So at the Space Command, Edgar Mitchell, one of the early moonwalkers, came and spoke out against space weapons, saying that if we are not careful, we will create a situation where we will be entombed to the planet Earth, and we will not be able to get a rocket off the Earth because of all of this space debris as a result of war and space. So it is indeed an environmental issue. You know, these militarists see space as vast and limitless, and we can do anything we want up there. But now the chickens are coming home to roost.
And given all of these probabilities and possibilities, and the fact that Trump is now in the White House, what is it that people can do to pressure the government, to pressure politicians to think differently about their actions and the repercussions from their actions, such as this increased debris in space essentially entombing humankind on the Earth? What can the average person do? How can they make a difference?
Well, they could first learn more about this issue. If they're at all interested, they could go to our website, which is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. And on our website, we have a video section that I highly recommend. You can go there and watch many different videos, documentaries, interviews, all different kinds of things that we've put together over many years. And you can learn a lot and hopefully share with other people. The other thing to know is that, as I said earlier, the aerospace industry has long said that space warfare will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And there was an editorial in one of the industry publications a few years back talking about the need to find a dedicated funding source for all of these programs, an editorial. And the editorial in the language part said, we've got to come up with a funding source that we control, and we have. And we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. And they said it was the entitlement programs that officially in America are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got finished with it. So these are the programs that the military-industrial complex has identified for defunding in order to move that money into the military budget to pay for Star Wars, all this war and space stuff. And so one way to help block the militarization and weaponization of space is to defend social progress, to fight for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, etc., to fight for welfare, to fight for nutrition programs and mental health programs. And when you do that, identify the goal of the militarist, that they want to use this money to militarize space and to use it for control and domination of the planet on behalf of corporate globalization. So we've got to begin to put all the pieces of the puzzle on the wall so the American people can begin to understand this big picture that is going on right now. A lot of people are very confused right now. In our old business model of single issue politics, organizing around a single issue, aren't going to work anymore. We've got to connect all these dots. And so one way to help defeat Star Wars is to begin to fight for social progress. In addition, let me just say that we're going to have our 25th annual conference and protest in Huntsville, Alabama on April 7th through the 9th. Huntsville is what they call the Pentagon of the South, and they're the directorate for the Pentagon of the Missile Defense Program. And so all the missile defense systems that are being deployed now today, both surrounding Russia and China, are being developed out of Huntsville, Alabama. So we invite people to consider joining us for that event. We'll have a protest at what they call the Redstone Arsenal on the first day, and then a weekend conference. And you can get more information about that at our website, spaceforpeace.org.
Well, on that note, Mr. Gagnon, thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak with us And we shall certainly look and study your website and participate and encourage others to participate in the work that you do, which is invaluable. And so thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much, Paulette.
Thank you.
Now you masters of war, you that build all of the guns, you that build the dead plains, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, just want you to know that I see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly, like the Judas of old. You lie, you deceive. World war can be won. You want me to I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the waters that run down my drain. You fasten the triggers for the others to fire and sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion as the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and buried in the mud. Well, that's the worst fear that can never be heard. Fear to bring children into the world, threatening my baby unborn and unnamed. Oh, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your. Much do I know to talk out of turn. You might say that I'm young, might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. Though I'm younger than you, even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. Well, that's the worst fear that can never be heard.
Odetta.
Odetta.
Sings Dylan's Masters of War. Wow, that was pretty powerful. And so, as we continue with this morning's program, reminding you, you are listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. And this program is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight, with Catherine Davis and
Paulette Spencer.
With
Matt Mazza.
There you go. You wanted to tell people about your project, Paulette.
Yes. I am in the process of preparing quite a few projects to keep Robert Knight's memory alive. And there are several things that I'm doing, which I will reveal more fully as they really come into being. But I wanted to let the audience know that if you want to learn about what I'm doing or be part of a mailing list that I'm putting out to sort of keep people informed, you can feel free to email me. And my email address is ps1337@nyu.edu. So that's P as in Paulette, S as in Spencer, number 1337@nyu.edu. And so as I move forward, I'll be a little bit less mysterious, but I promise you this is worth the wait, and it has staying power.
Okay. Well, since the inspiration for Earth at Midnight was Earthwatch with Robert Knight, let's play his old theme song.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. The beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? The man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown, to know that millions of babies still starve, millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. Innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? Stop and see. When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
And that was Stevie Wonder. And The Bell for Freedom Shall Ring. Is that the name of it?
The Bell of Freedom.
The Bell of Freedom. Beautiful. And now we're going to return to our serial reading of Ishmael with Matt Mazza. So Matt, catch everybody up and continue for your reading for, I guess, 20 minutes?
Okay.
20-minute segment?
Very good. Well, we finished Ishmael and his student. We're discussing mother culture and its influence. And this was at the end of chapter 8. Before we quit today, I have a question. Why mother culture? I personally have no difficulty with it, but I can imagine some women would on the grounds that you seem to be singling out a figure of specifically female gender to serve as a cultural villain. Ishmael grunted. I don't consider her a villain in any sense whatever, but I understand what you're getting at. Here is my answer. Culture is a mother everywhere and at every time, because culture is inherently a nurturer, the nurturer of human societies and lifestyles. Among lever peoples, mother culture explains and preserves a lifestyle that is healthy and self-sustaining. Among taker peoples, she explains and preserves a lifestyle that has proven to be unhealthy and self-destructive. Okay, so? So, what's your question? If culture is a mother among Alawa of Australia and the Bushmen of Africa and the Caiapo of Brazil, then why wouldn't she be a mother among the takers? And that was the end of chapter 8. And we proceed with chapter 9, subsection 1. When I arrived the next day, I found that a new plan was in effect. Ishmael was no longer on the other side of the glass. He was on my side of it, sprawled on some cushions a few feet from my chair. I hadn't realized how important that sheet of glass had become in our relationship, to be honest. I felt a flutter of alarm in my stomach. His nearness and enormity disconcerted me. But without hesitating for more than a fraction of a second, I took my seat and gave him my usual nod of greeting. He nodded back, but I thought I glimpsed a look of wary speculation in his eyes, as if my proximity troubled him as much as his troubled me. "Before we go on," Ishmael said after a few moments, "I want to clear up a misconception." He held up a pad of drawing paper with a diagram on it. 3000 B.C. and coming forward to 2000 A.D., levers is marked underneath. Not a particularly difficult visualization. "It represents the storyline of the levers," he said. "Yes, I see." He added something and held it up again. 3000 B.C., coming forward, going back to 8000 B.C., and the takers coming up to 2000 A.D. This offshoot, beginning at about 8000 B.C., represents the storyline of the takers. "Right. And what event does this represent?" he asked, touching the point of his pencil to the dot labeled 8000 B.C. "The agricultural revolution." "Did this event occur at a point in time or over a period of time?" "I assume over a period of time." "Then this dotted 8000 B.C. represents what?" "The beginning of the revolution." "Where shall I put the dot to show when it ended?" "Ah," I said witlessly, "I don't really know. It must have lasted a couple of thousand years." "What event marked the end of the revolution?" "Again, I don't know. I don't know that any particular event would have marked it." "No popping champagne corks?" "I don't know." "Think." I thought, and after a while said, "Okay, it's strange that this isn't taught. I remember being taught about the agricultural revolution, but I don't remember this." "Go on." "It didn't end. It just spread. It's been spreading ever since it began. Back there 10,000 years ago, it spread across this continent during the 18th and 19th centuries. It's still spreading across parts of New Zealand and Africa and South America today." "Of course. So you see that your agricultural revolution is not an event like the Trojan War, isolated in the distant past and without direct relevance to your lives today. The work began by those Neolithic farmers in the Near East has been carried forward from one generation to the next without a single break right into the present moment. It's the foundation of your vast civilization today in exactly the same way that it was the foundation of the very first farming village. Yes, I see that. This should help you understand why the story you tell your children about the meaning of the world, about divine intentions in the world, and about the destiny of man is of such profound importance to the people of your culture. It's the manifesto of the revolution on which your culture is based. It's the repository of all your revolutionary doctrine and the definitive expression of your revolutionary spirit. It explains why the revolution was necessary and why it must be carried forward at any cost whatever. Yes, I said, that's quite a thought. Subsection 2, Chapter 9. About 2,000 years ago, Ishmael went on, an event of exquisite irony occurred within your culture. The takers, or at least a very large segment of them, adopted as their own a story that seemed to them pregnant with meaning and mystery. It came to them from a taker people of the Near East who had been telling it to their own children for countless generations, for so many generations that it had become a mystery even to them. Do you know why? Why it had become a mystery? No. It had become a mystery because those who first told the story, their ancient ancestors, were not takers, but leavers. I sat there for a while, blinking at him. Then I asked him if he'd mind running that past me again. About 2,000 years ago, the takers adopted as their own a story that had originated among leavers many centuries before. Okay, what's the story in that? What's the irony in that? The irony is that it was a story that had once been told among leavers about the origins of the takers. The takers adapted as their own, a leaver story about their origins. I'm afraid I don't get it. What sort of story would a leaver people tell about the appearance of the takers in the world? God, I have no idea. Ishmael peered at me owlishly. You seem to have forgotten to take your brainy pill this morning. Never mind, I'll tell you a story of my own, and then you'll see it. Okay. Ishmael shifted his mountainous bulk into a new position on his pillows, and involuntarily I closed my eyes, thinking, if a stranger were to open the door and walk in at this moment, what on earth could he think? Subsection 3. There is a very special knowledge you must have if you're going to rule the world, Ishmael said. I'm sure you realize that. Frankly, I've never thought about it. The takers possess this knowledge, of course. At least they imagine they do. And they're very, very proud of it. This is the most fundamental knowledge of all, and it's absolutely indispensable to those who would rule the world. And what do you suppose the takers find when they go among the leavers? I don't know what you mean. They find that the leavers do not have this knowledge. Isn't that remarkable? I don't know. Consider it. The takers have a knowledge that enables them to rule the world, and the leavers lack it. This is what the missionaries found wherever they went among the leavers. They were quite astonished with themselves because they had the impression that this knowledge was virtually self-evident. I don't even know what knowledge you're talking about. It's the knowledge that's needed to rule the world. Okay, but specifically, what knowledge is that? You learn that from the story. What I'm looking at right now is who has this knowledge. I've told you that the takers have it, and that makes sense, doesn't it? The takers are the rulers of the world, aren't they? Yes. And the leavers don't have it. And that too makes sense, doesn't it? I guess so. Now tell me this. Who else would have this knowledge besides the takers? I have no idea. Think mythologically. Okay, the gods would have it. Of course. And that's what my story is about. How the gods acquired the knowledge that they needed to rule the world. Subsection 4. One day, Ishmael began, the gods were considering the administration of the world in the ordinary way, and one of them said, "Here's a spot I've been thinking about for a while, a wide, pleasant savanna. Let's send a great multitude of locusts into this land. Then the fire of life will grow prodigiously in them, and in the birds and the lizards that will feed on them, and that will be very fine." The others thought about this for a while. Then one said, "It's certainly true that if we send the locusts into this land, the fire of life will blaze in them, and in the creatures that feed on them, but at the expense of all the other creatures that live there." The others asked him what his point was, and he went on, "Surely it would be a great crime to deprive all these other creatures of the fire of life that the locusts and the birds and the lizards can flourish for a time. For the locusts will strip the land bare, and the deer and the gazelles and the goats and the rabbits will go hungry and die. And with the disappearance of the game, the lions and the wolves and the foxes will soon be dying too. Won't they curse us then and call us criminals for favoring the locusts and the birds and the lizards over them?" Now the gods had to scratch their heads over this, because they'd never looked at matters at this particular light before. But finally one of them said, "I don't see that this presents any great problem. We simply won't do it. We won't raise a multitude of locusts to send into this land. Then things will go on as before, and no one will have any reason to curse us." Most of the gods thought this made sense, but one of them disagreed. "Surely this could be as great a crime as the other," he said, "for don't the locusts and the birds and the lizards live in our land as well as the rest? Is it never to be their time to flourish greatly as others do?" While the gods were debating this point, a fox came out to hunt, and they said, "Let's send the fox a quail for its life." But these words were hardly spoken when one of them said, "Surely it would be a crime to let the fox live at the quail's expense." The quail has its life that we gave it and lives in our lands. It would be infamous to send it into the jaws of the fox. Then another said, look here, the quail is stalking a grasshopper. If we don't give the quail to the fox, then the quail will eat the grasshopper. Doesn't the grasshopper have its life that we gave it, and doesn't it live in our lands as truly as the quail? Surely it would be a crime not to give the quail to the fox, so that the grasshopper may live. Well, as you can imagine, the gods groaned heavily over this and didn't know what to do. And while they were wrangling over it, spring came, and the snow waters of the mountains began to swell the streams, and one of them said, surely it would be a crime to let these waters flood the land, for countless creatures are bound to be carried off to their deaths. But then another said, surely it would be a crime not to let these waters flood the land, for without them, the ponds and the marshes will dry up, and all the creatures that live on them will die. And once more, the gods were thrown into confusion. Finally, one of them had what seemed to be a new thought. It's clear that any action we take will be good for some and evil for others. So let's take no action at all. Then none of the creatures that live in our land can call us criminals. Nonsense, another snapped. If we take no action at all, this will also be good for some and evil for others, won't it? The creatures that live in our lands will say, look, we suffer and the gods do nothing. And while the gods bickered among themselves, the locusts swarmed over the savanna, and the locusts and the lizards and praised the gods, while the game and the predators died cursing the gods. And because the gods had taken no action in the matter, the quail lived, and the fox went hungry to its hole, cursing the gods. And because the quail lived, it ate the grasshopper, and the grasshopper died, cursing the gods. And because, in the end, the gods decided to stem the flood of spring waters, the ponds and the marshes dried up, and all the thousands of creatures that lived in them died, cursing the gods. And hearing all these curses, the gods groaned. We've made the garden a place of terror, and all that live in it hate us as tyrants and criminals, and they're right to do so, because by action or inaction, we send them good one day and evil the next, without knowing what we should do. The savanna, stripped by the locusts, rings with curses, and we have to answer to make the fox and the grasshopper curse us because we let the quail live, and we have no answer to make. Surely the whole world must curse the day we made it, for we are criminals who send good and evil by turns, knowing that even as we do it, that we don't know what ought to be done. Well, the gods were sinking right into the slough of despond when one of them looked up and said, say, we didn't make for the garden a certain tree whose fruit is the knowledge of good and evil. Yes, cried the other. Let's find the tree and eat it and eat of it, and see what this knowledge is. And when the gods had found this tree and had tasted it, its fruit, their eyes were opened and said, Now indeed we have the knowledge we need to tend the garden without becoming criminals and without earning the curses of all who live in our lands.
Are you going, said the man at his desk. Oh, I'm going to a new world, said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I'm going to a new world, said the child, and he stood.
Oh, I'm sounding drums of war,
said the man.
Oh, I will not fight your war,
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
Oh, I will not fight your war,
said the child, and he stood. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man at his desk.
Yes, I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood. And he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood.
Oh, but don't you know the truth,
said the man at his desk.
Yes, you lie and call it truth,
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. You lie and call it truth, said the child, and he stood.
And so, I don't remember the name of that artist, but the name of that song is called The Bell. And it is clearly an anti-war song.
Stephen Smith, it says.
Stephen Smith.
The Bell.
The mm-hmm. Bell. And this was a very early performance, I think, back from the 1990s. And I know that we all were aware of the marches that took place across the globe this past Saturday, celebrating womanhood and also sort of striking a position vis-a-vis Donald Trump and his intentions towards women's health care, and also the statements that he's made in terms of his lack of manners, if I'm going to put that politely, when it comes to treating women. And today I was looking on the internet and noticed that we're talking about immigration. And of course, immigration includes men and women and families, mm-hmm. and how we now have this sort of crop of cities and places in the U.S. which are declaring themselves to be sanctuary cities, to protect people who are here who may not be documented, from Trump's wishes to basically go and collect them and deport them from the country. And I found this very interesting in that there's an irony. It's one thing when you hold sanctions against other countries, but it's another thing when you're actually declaring that you're going to have sanctions against states or cities for disagreeing with Trump's wish to go after anyone who is here, who is undocumented. And New York City is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the triple irony is that he's from New York City. And New York City didn't vote for him.
Well, there's no end to the ironies of Trump, of the days of Trump, Trump and the Trumpets. Well, it's rather ridiculous. He's creating more chaos and dissension, and he's going to have cities and fighting the government. And I think more and more people beginning to realize what a sad story this is turning out to be. But I'm sure New York City is not going to take that very easily.
Yes, and they're not going to take it easily. And the fact is that he's threatening to keep or cut off any federal funding to any of these cities that offer sanctuary.
Well, remember back to your interview with Bruce Gagnon. So this is probably just a ruse.
Sure.
To cut off services to people so that they can have access to that money for other things.
Absolutely. And furthermore, his wishes are to restrict the travel from people from certain countries with large Muslim populations, including Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. However, it does not include Egypt, Turkey, or Saudi Arabia, where the Trump family has family endeavors.
Well, those sound like the same families that were very cozy to the Clintons and the Bushes as well.
That's right.
Same countries. Same deal, same story. So, yeah, I think these are going to be very interesting times. I mean, it's absurd, rather absurd, all of these things that are being put into place. And just like the tremendous global march, really, that took place on Saturday, the 21st, for the Women's March, I think there's going to be a lot and lot more of these things taking place. I believe there's going to be some very specific lobbying to congressional representatives, the Senate and the House, because this is really going so beyond. And all of these services that are going to be taken away from people is going to be catastrophic. So it's designed, it seems, to create absolute chaos. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, because it's imperative that we not succumb to that chaos.
Certainly, and he's very good at creating the sort of artificial chaos.
Yeah, and I think we have to be careful not to fall into too much fear about these things, or to fall into conflict with each other based on what's happening from Washington. So I think certainly a great deal of the citizens, the people of New York, see this for what it is and are not going to be cooperating with it. It doesn't look like de Blasio is going to be cooperating with this whole demand to not be a safe harbor for immigrant and non-documented workers. I certainly don't think that that's worth giving up. It sounds like the American Revolution and the Tea Party, you know? It sounds like a real coming together of opposite notions. So it'll be interesting to see how it all works. I'm just cautioning us all not to get crazy.
Definitely.
And not to get frightened, because the level of absurdity of all of this will begin to permeate the consciousness, the mass consciousness. And I believe that even those beings who supported and voted for him are either in the camp with him or are going to reevaluate. People who were looking to buck the system, to change the system, must realize at this point that we've gone like a laser beam in the opposite direction of furthering the corruption. So we'll see what happens. And I just, you know, all of this is coming out. It'll be something to deal with. I'm happy it's not secret undercover stuff, that we can deal with it. We have the information and we can do something about it. So I'm encouraged by that.
And I was encouraged by the crowds on Saturday. Part of my days I spent walking right next to them. I wasn't in the middle of the street because they were sort of caged in a bit. Mm-hmm. But I was next to them for about 15 blocks. And
here in New York City.
Here in New York City. And mm-hmm. I understand 250,000 people came.
It was an amazing thing because they were, I believe there were over 600 rallies at least in at least 57 countries. So it was a global phenomena. And what I saw that was really interesting, I was here doing the coverage from the station, is that this is much more than your usual activists. These are really moms and pops and people who wouldn't normally have taken to the streets. So I think that the consciousness of people is very expansive at this point. Everyone jumped onto this, and it's not just women. It's men, women, children. And I think there could have been more diversity, possibly. I think that people who might have felt vulnerable stayed home. But still, it was a remarkable, remarkable day. And we have much more to do and to connect with each other. And I'm just want to put out there, this is why WBAI is so imperative. To thrive, to survive through this era, so that we can really look at these issues in ways that you're really not going to find on mainstream or in most listener-sponsored, you know, nonprofit radio. A lot of that is also somewhat corporate. So WBAI is totally supported by listeners and not by corporate foundations, as some of the others are. So it's a good... putting the word out there to make sure that you support this radio station.
And our shows are archived, and this morning particularly with Mimi Rosenberg, she did a wonderful job. She was in Washington, and she got really good recordings of the speeches, many different people speaking, and really, really good job. You can hear it. Just tune into the, just go on the website. Hear the archives.
All right, so we're just about out of time. I'm going to play a little song in honor of Donald Trump called Under My Thumb. And then with whatever time is left, we'll hear a bit of Come to the River by Diane Reeves. So take care. Join us again next Wednesday. I believe will be the last week before the drive. So we expect to be here. And we look forward to sharing this time.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
Just a reminder that if people want to learn more about what's being done to preserve Robert Knight's legacy, please send me an email. My email is ps1337@nyu.edu.
Okay.
Yes, it is the way she does. where the healing waters flow. There will be mountains to climb and valleys dark as the night, and roads you have never known. Follow the answers to the questions in your soul. Down by the water where the river gates control.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, via Skype, our guest will be editor Neil Clark of Clark's World and other things. Stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I've got to apologize again. I did see Split, M. Night Shyamalan's newest film about a man with dissociative identity disorder, multiple personalities, in other words, played by James McAvoy, who kidnaps three teenage women, prime among them Casey, a loner with her own demons, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, to use them as quote-unquote sacred food. I saw it during a regular screening with a good-sized audience, an audience, it turns out, that wasn't quite receiving it the way Shyamalan probably intended. Lots of laughter in there, so much so that I couldn't filter it out, which I'm usually good at, and develop my own feelings about the film. I point this out because afterward, I saw a clip from the film on TV, a clip which the audience treated as hilarious, and that thing creeped me out in the absence of their laughter. I will say this, I don't think the people I saw it with were completely unjustified in their response. There is good stuff in Split, particularly McAvoy's disturbing portrayal of multiple personalities, including an 8-year-old and a female zealot awaiting the advent of a mysterious superhuman beast, and there's a beautifully handled final confrontation between Casey and her captor. But the characterizations, particularly of the teens, are poorly motivated and a little too broad, a failing both of Shyamalan's writing and directing of the actors. In addition, Shyamalan introduces a fantastic element that doesn't quite sit well with the rest of the scenario, and then ties that into one of his earlier films in a twist, the legendary Shyamalan twist, that will have some people who know the director's work groaning, and others intrigued. And here's where the audience response tripped me up. I would have liked to have watched the film on my own terms so I could better take in what is revealed about the particular Shyamalan universe we're in that twist, which here is isolated to a coda that doesn't really impact the plot of the film, and determine if it brings a new context to the film as a whole, or if Shyamalan is just indulging in some ill-advised audience tweaking. I can't do that now. Not with the vibe I experienced in that auditorium. I will probably watch Split again privately. I'm suspecting that it won't seriously change my opinion of the film. This won't land as one of Shyamalan's top efforts. By the way, you should check out last year's The Visit if you haven't yet. It's really good. But I am hoping to see additional value in it that was blocked for me this time. On the other hand, there was no effort needed to see the value in the 1947 French film Panique. Now playing at the Film Forum in New York, this tale of a triangle between a woman recently released from jail, the murderous boyfriend she took the rap for, and the fake psychic who falls for her is a fantastic example of French film noir, and a dark examination of suspicion and malice in a country only 2 years removed from World War II. If you want something lighter, Well Go USA recently released the live-action martial arts fantasy The Monkey King 2 on home video. I had some problems with the first film, which, like this one, is based on the Chinese classic Journey to the North, prime among them an overload of obviously fake CG effects. The same sin is committed here, but to his credit, director Soi Chang grants more empathy to the title character, here played with lashings of simian energy by Aaron Kwok, as he struggles against his instinctive self-interest and battles to gain the trust of his traveling companions, including a monk played by William Feng. It's fun, it's a bit too much, but I did enjoy it. And by the way, if you remember the Japanese animated film Alakazam the Great, which was also based on Journey to the North, Monkey King 2 is where you start to recognize some characters that were also referenced in that film. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And for Hour of the Wolf, I'm Jim Freund. So, the way Skype works here is peculiar, but I am going to try to contact Neil now. If I did it off the air. Ooh, are you there? Hello, Neil. Are you hearing me? Are you receiving me? I can see your living room. Not that that matters. Oh, there you are. Hi. Say something. Ooh. Oh, okay. Hold on. Try that again.
Hello?
Yes. Ah, there we are. We've got a bit of lag, but you are indeed on the air, and not bad sound quality. I won't discuss. It's weird that I can see you, just like when we did our test run before, but now I'm actually using the WBAI studio. Is the sound okay on your end?
Perfect.
Okay, good.
I'm just getting an echo of myself.
Yeah, you know, Skype, I had hoped when Microsoft bought Skype and took it over, which is almost, I think, like 5 years at this point, that they would improve certain things. But I've been a little bit, as a technology reviewer, which I used to be, a little bit disappointed in that, I have to say. It's still got lag, time lag problems and echoes, and it's one of the reasons why I prefer, well, of course, I prefer face-to-face interviews always, but in recognition of the modern world and in recognition also that I'm also producing things now for my own podcast eventually, Skype is going to be that much more important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, my guest this morning, everybody, is Neil Clark. That's with an E on the end. He is the editor of Clark's World magazine, which has won 3 Hugo Awards and a World Fantasy Award. We haven't said what this is. Galactic Empires is a new, very handsome book from Nightshade Books, a thick, nifty 600-plus page anthology, original anthology, all new stories.
No. They're reprints.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, who cares? Well, it's, you know, it's a great collection.
Oh, thank you.
Bottom line. Okay, but that makes it... No, well, a collection is usually one author. And your first one was... Upgraded?